The sun wouldn't rise for another 2 hours, but 35-year-old Catherine Adam was already making her way to work. Climbing into her van, she made the short trip from her apartment to the local convenience store in Salina, Kansas, on the morning of April 29, 1993. After grabbing a cup of coffee and a newspaper, she was supposed to drive to a nearby storage facility to pick up supplies for work, but Catherine never made it to work that day. When she didn't return home, her 16-year-old daughter called police. Tracing her steps, investigators arrived at the storage park, and while they didn't find Catherine, they did find a large pool of blood just outside the door. Not long after, her work van was found abandoned at a local restaurant. The outside was caked with mud, and the inside was soaked in blood. Massive searches were launched for Catherine, who investigators believed had been seriously wounded, but spring and summer flooding eradicated any potential trail. Salina is surrounded by miles and miles of farmland, forestry, and dirt roads, and she could have been taken in any direction. As time moved on, what had begun as the search for a missing woman slowly transformed into the hunt for a killer. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 149, The Vanishing of Catherine Adam. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we examine the mysterious circumstances surrounding the disappearance and likely murder of Catherine Adam. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. 35-year-old Catherine Adam had finally decided to move on. She left her husband of nearly 20 years and, taking her 16-year-old daughter along with her, moved to Salina, Kansas for a new beginning. Before she could even begin that life, however, someone stole it away in cold blood. This is Episode 149, The Vanishing of Catherine Adam. Clouds had been gathering in the sky above Salina throughout the day, but as the sun began moving more steadily towards the horizon, those clouds had darkened, and the scent of impending rain permeated the air. The main roadways were beginning to thin out as rush hour adjusted from a crawl to a dash, with fewer and fewer commuters needing to complete their trip home. For several members of the Salina Police Department, though, their vehicles continued to cruise along slowly as they scanned every business, every parking lot, every empty field for a white van, or better yet, Catherine Adam, the missing woman who had been driving it. The slow droning of the road was stifled by the electric buzz of the radio coming to life. Units were being dispatched to check out a small storage facility on the south side of town. Catherine's boss explained to investigators that, as part of her morning routine, she would stop at the facility and load her van up with product to deliver to different stores. If they could find any sign she'd made it that far, they might have a better idea of where she had gone next. Heading west on Magnolia, the rows of metal units came into view where the road met Centennial, and two quick turns later, police came to a stop. One unit stood out. Its door hung wide open, and several pieces of merchandise were scattered on the floor inside. It wasn't the interior that caught police attention, though, but the drying pool of blood splattered on the concrete just outside the door. It wasn't enough to suggest a lethal wound, but it was clearly the result of something significant. As more police arrived to secure and examine the scene, another call came buzzing through the static of multiple patrol vehicles parked nearby. They had found the van, parked at a restaurant just a few miles away, but it wasn't all good news. As investigators popped open the heavy rear doors, they saw blood everywhere. Suddenly, it became apparent that what had begun as the search for a missing mother might end with the hunt for a killer. Catherine Louise Swenson was born on February 6, 1958, to parents Harry and Mary in Atchison County, Kansas. Catherine was their first child and would be followed a few years later by their last, a second daughter named Deborah. Harry and Mary were farmers, and while farm life can be exciting and fun for a child, it can also be a lot of hard work keeping things in order. Catherine grew up on the family farm just outside of Lancaster, a small city in the northwest quadrant of Atchison, seated against a stretch of Route 73. Rural may not be an accurate way to describe Lancaster, which seems more like an outpost surrounded by vast farms with the city itself squeezed into less than 0.2 square miles and a population of just 200. As a child, Catherine fell in love with music and enjoyed singing. Local newspaper articles throughout her early years note her as belonging to the school band and choir. She also sang in church, and according to her mother, she enjoyed playing piano. Mary taught guitar for several years, and during that time, Catherine would sit in on classes hoping to learn to play herself. If there's one detail which remains consistent throughout her life, it's that love of music, which her daughter mentions was something they both shared. Catherine attended Effingham Junior High, where she was noted as having made the honor roll each year. Moving on, she went to Atchison County Community High School, where she continued her high grades and participation in musical performances. During her time there, the high school began expanding on girls' sports, and Catherine was involved with track, where she was among some of the first female athletes to letter under the new program. Several articles from the Atchison Daily Globe discussed medical issues in the community, and Catherine's name popped up a few times with her being hospitalized for the mumps and later a severely injured arm. There's also mention of Catherine picking up a job at a local jewelry store in June of 74 when she would have been 16. While Catherine had always excelled at school, according to her mother, things began changing as she completed her sophomore year. In discussion with the Salina Journal, Mary described her daughter as being both moody and down, saying, quote, "she wasn't happy most of her life," end quote. During her later high school years, Kathy apparently experimented with drugs and had a few run-ins with the law. This was enough for her parents to place her with a foster family in the city of Hope, some 150 miles to the southwest. This was a drastic change for Catherine, who would move from her small, familiar town to living with a new family in a new place while attending a new school. This move would also change the trajectory of her life forever. For her junior year, Catherine attended Hope Rural High School in 1975, and it was here that she met Gerald Arthur Adam. It appears their relationship developed rapidly as on October 30th, it was announced that the two were engaged to be married. At the time of their wedding, which took place in Atchison on Sunday, November 2nd, Catherine was 17 years old and Gerald was 18. The wedding was attended by Catherine's family, with her father walking her down the aisle and her sister registering the guests. Following their nuptials, Catherine went on to complete her senior year at Topeka High School, 60 miles from Lancaster. While in previous years, Catherine had appeared in multiple groups and organizations, in her 76-year book, only her senior portrait appears. Following graduation, the newlyweds moved, first to Abilene, where Gerald's parents lived, and then to Solomon, 20 minutes outside of Salina, where they purchased a farm. According to Mary, Gerald both worked as a farmer and truck driver at the same time. She stated that the family got on very well with him, telling the Salina Journal, quote, "Gerald is the nicest, kindest man. He was never a problem. He's probably closer with our family than he is with his own," end quote. Later that year in December, Catherine would give birth to the couple's first and only child, a daughter they would name Laura. While Mary seemed to adore her son-in-law, Laura would describe a very different man in the only interview she's ever given. Speaking to Erin Matthews of the Salina Journal in April of 2013, Laura described an unhappy home with two parents who didn't get along but went out of their way to keep up appearances. Laura explained she didn't like the way her father treated her mother, saying, quote, "They kept it behind closed doors, but I wasn't stupid. I knew what was going on. There were a lot of facades being played. Truly, to this day, I don't think the rest of the family knows the type of relationship my parents had or had with me." End quote. According to Laura, she had to grow up fast in a difficult environment where neither parent seemed to want to be a parent. That would change over the years, at least for Catherine, who became very involved in Laura's life, supporting her extracurricular activities. As Laura would describe it, quote, "I was an athlete, and she enjoyed coming to my games and cheering me on. She was really great. My friends thought she was cool." End quote. Her relationship with her father, though, continued to decline. He wasn't around much, being on the road a lot, working as a driver, but even when he was at best ambivalent and at worst, actively ignoring her. According to Laura, the family upheld appearances, pretending to be happy at holiday gatherings and family events, though she herself described the marriage as, quote, "not a healthy relationship at all," end quote. Everything came to a head in early 1993, when she was 16 years old. According to the Salina Journal, Catherine arrived home one evening flanked by sheriff's deputies who stood watch as she and Laura packed up what few belongings they needed and left the home in Solomon for the final time. Laura explained that due to the speed with which things had happened, she left almost everything behind, including childhood mementos and family photographs. When asked about the separation, Mary had little to offer, explaining that Catherine simply said she was fed up and moving out. In March, Catherine and her teenage daughter moved into the Iron Crest Apartments, located at 210 West Iron Avenue in Salina. Less than 2 months later, Catherine would mysteriously vanish. According to Mary, in the 5 years leading up to the separation, Catherine had worked several different jobs in Abilene, Junction City, and Salina. As she put it, her daughter was always moving on. Sometime, Catherine picked up a job working for Legs, a pantyhose brand owned by Hanes, which had seen a rise to popularity throughout the 70s and 80s, but was, by the early 90s, beginning to see shrinking profits. It was during this time that they aired memorable commercials, in which a very loose cover of ZZ Top's famous Legs was played, establishing the new slogan for the pantyhose, "She's Got Legs." While not pertinent to the case, I thought I'd mention this just because I remember these commercials being on constantly during the early 90s. It was shortly after Catherine obtained this job that she apparently made the decision to take her daughter and leave the home in Solomon. According to police, as part of her job, Catherine would fill Legs stock at stores from a white Econoline van, which had the Legs logo on the side of it with blue writing. Early in the morning, she'd head over to a storage unit to load the van with new stock, and then she'd fill in Legs displays for general sales or promotional events. While it was work and money would be coming in, Catherine wasn't exactly thrilled with the hours. According to her daughter, she expressed some concern about being out on her own in the quiet hours before sunrise. Laura explained that she tried to talk her mother out of the job, saying it wasn't safe for her to be working all alone in the dark, but Catherine was willing to make the trade-off, because early mornings meant she'd make it home before Laura got home from school, and she wanted to be there waiting for her. For the most part, the days were easy, just moving from one place to another to fill stock, but there wasn't a lot of time for getting to know anyone. One employee of a local Walmart told the Salina Journal that Catherine would only be in the store for 15 to 20 minutes once a week, and that while she was there, she was focused on her work and didn't take a lot of time to chat or socialize. This continues a pattern we've seen throughout Catherine's life, this dichotomy in descriptions of her behavior and personality, with some saying she was often down, moody, and somewhat cold, while others, such as Maxine Rogers, the manager for Ironcrest Apartments, called her upbeat and a go-getter who was very sociable and involved in her daughter's life. In Rogers' opinion, if Catherine did seem down or distant, it was likely due to the pending divorce, with her explaining, quote, "She wasn't a bitter person. She was sad about the divorce, but accepted it and was ready to go on with her own life," end quote. When asked whether or not she'd ever mentioned her soon-to-be ex-husband, Rogers stated that she had mentioned him, but never spoke ill of him, nor did she seem to place the cause of the divorce solely on his shoulders. The apartment Catherine rented wasn't exactly ideal for a mother and teenage daughter, being a one-bedroom, but it was what she could afford at the time. She'd been working hard and saving to move into a bigger space at the Villa Bonita Apartments on East Crawford, and everything seemed to be falling into place for that move to occur in May. Unfortunately, Catherine would never make that move. On the morning of Wednesday, April 28th, Catherine left the Ironcrest Apartments just after 4 a.m., as was her normal routine. She picked up stock from the storage unit on Centennial and made her normal stops throughout the day. According to her boss, everything seemed to go on as normal. After work, Catherine headed home to get ready as she had made plans to go see a play with some friends at the Salina Community Theater. Back at the Ironcrest, she ran into Maxine Rogers, and the two chatted for a few minutes. According to Rogers, they discussed Catherine's piano, which she had saved up to buy, and she was now fearing might not fit in her new apartment. Rogers said the conversation was short, explaining, quote, "When I left her Wednesday, she was talking about that, and she was saying she needed to hurry and put on her face because people were waiting for her to go to the play," end quote. The two parted ways at approximately 6 p.m. Catherine went out for the evening, returning home around 11. Mother and daughter talked for a bit, but both had to get up early the next day, Catherine for work and Laura for school. Sadly, this would be the last time Laura ever saw her mother, for the next morning she was off to work before sunrise, and she never came home. When Laura came home in the afternoon on Thursday, the 29th, and found her mother wasn't there, she didn't immediately find it troubling. Maybe work had run late, or she had made other plans, meeting a friend or finalizing details for the new apartment. It wasn't until day turned to evening and evening to night that Laura began worrying. At some point, she drifted off to sleep, but when she awoke on the morning of Friday the 30th and found no indications that her mother had ever come home, she knew something was wrong. Laura decided to call some of Catherine's co-workers to see if they had seen or spoken with her in the previous 24 hours. It was at that time she learned not only had her mother not been seen, she apparently had not made any of her deliveries on Thursday the 29th. Laura was advised to contact police, and her call came in at approximately 11 a.m. on the 30th, at which time the Salina Police Department issued a be-on-the-lookout order for Catherine and or the white van she was driving. The initial interview with Laura was painful, with her describing herself as being in shock and beginning to question the motives of everyone in her life. Police were able to ascertain some of Catherine's morning routine, and this would ultimately lead them to the storage facility. Triplets Mini Storage, as it was called at the time, was located near the intersection of Magnolia and Centennial, approximately 4 miles south of Catherine's apartment. Upon arriving on the scene, police found evidence that indicated someone had been seriously wounded. There was a large pool of blood just outside the door, which had been left open, and there was a smaller amount of blood inside. At the time, Lieutenant Dean Bonowitz of the Salina Police Department told the Journal that they didn't think robbery was a motive, as nothing appeared to be missing from the storage container. Bonowitz also stated no bullet holes were found, either inside or outside, nor had a weapon been recovered. When asked if there had been any sign of a struggle, Bonowitz stated that they had nothing to indicate that. However, 12 years later, Lieutenant Scott Simpson contradicted those statements when speaking to KSN-TV. According to Simpson, evidence at the scene did show that a struggle had taken place. In addition to that, Bullet fragments were recovered from the storage unit, and police believe someone had been shot at the scene. While there are no specifics, it's also been said that it looked like someone had attempted to clean up after themselves, as only some fragments were recovered and no shell casings. It was theorized at the time that someone may have been at the storage unit lying in wait, and when Catherine began loading the van, she was attacked by one or more suspects. After being shot, she was likely moved into the back of the van, at which point the shooter drove off. At approximately 6 p.m., while the storage unit was being documented and analyzed, reports came in that officers had located Catherine's work van 3 miles to the north in the parking lot of Russell's restaurant at 649 Westport Boulevard, which at the time was closed for remodeling. According to investigators, inside the rear section of the van they found additional blood, though this was not the only clue yielded by the discovery. The van itself had a large amount of mud kicked up along its lower exterior and above the wheel wells, indicating that it had been driven off-road at some point, believed to be after Catherine's disappearance. This presented a large problem, as Saline County Sheriff Darrell Wilson later explained, quote, "With a county that's 30 miles long and 30 miles wide, and that has 1,100 miles of road, it's difficult to do an adequate search unless you have a specific place to look. If a body is off the road or buried, you're never going to find it." End quote. After discovery of the van, police worked quickly to get as much information to the media as possible. A picture of Catherine was released to the public, along with a physical description of both her and the van she was driving the day she vanished. It was hoped that locals might have seen Catherine or the van sometime on Thursday the 29th, and while police had reason to believe something terrible had happened, they didn't reveal that at the time. Assistant Police Chief Glenn Kokonowski told the Salina Journal, quote, "We have no idea what could have happened to her. We need help. Anyone who has information about the van or who has information, no matter how insignificant they think it may be, should call us." End quote. At the same time, samples of the blood found at the storage unit and in the van were being sent to the Kansas Bureau of Investigation to determine whether or not it belonged to Catherine. By this time, investigators were also working to interview everyone in Catherine's life. In an article dated May 2nd, 2 days after Catherine had been reported missing and 3 days after she had last been seen, it was noted that police had interviewed Gerald and that at the time he was not considered a suspect. Through their interviews, police determined it was highly unlikely Catherine would have run off somewhere. Multiple people specified she would never leave her daughter behind, not to mention all the blood they had found made it unlikely she had gone anywhere on her own. At that point, the department took on a more grim outlook, with Lieutenant Bonowitz telling the media on May 3rd, quote, "We fear she is probably deceased, but we still hope to find her alive." End quote. While police received multiple calls from witnesses who believed they may have seen at least the van on the morning of the 29th, one caller reported he had both spoken and interacted with Catherine. An employee working the overnight shift at the Quick Shop gas station and convenience store stated that Catherine had come in during the early morning hours, purchased a cup of coffee and a newspaper, and then left. The convenience store, located at 1727 West Crawford, was 2 miles north of the storage facility and less than a third of a mile from the restaurant where the van was later found. The convenience store had surveillance cameras at the time, which captured images of Catherine entering and exiting. The final image of Catherine shows the 35-year-old mother carrying a cup of coffee in her right hand and a newspaper in her left. Exiting the store, she turned, using her backside to push the door open since her hands were full. This gave a very clear image of her and showed her wearing a blue Kansas City Royals baseball jacket over a light-colored button-up shirt. She also wore black pants and shoes. According to the timestamp, it was 4:33 a.m. when Catherine left the store. Police believe that she had likely stopped in for her coffee and newspaper and to gas up the van before heading towards the storage facility to load up for that day's deliveries. This helped narrow their window, with them believing Catherine had likely been abducted between 4:30 and 5:30 a.m. At that point, police believed they were more likely looking for a body rather than finding Catherine alive. Investigators began checking along dirt roads and farmland, looking for spots with flattened grass or tire marks indicating that someone may have driven through, but the arrival of spring rains was washing away whatever evidence there may have been. Police were also following up on tips, examining a mile stretch of land near the intersection of West Magnolia and South Burma Road, a few miles outside of town and in the middle of rural farmland. This search was initiated after a woman called in, claiming to have seen a white van in that area the morning Catherine vanished. Nothing came out of that search, nor another executed at a railroad boxcar 15 miles north of Salina, near the town of Bennington. At one point, the Topeka police loaned out a helicopter, which flew over the fields and farms surrounding Salina while utilizing thermal imaging, though this yielded no results and would only show body heat if someone were alive. While searches hadn't turned up any sign of Catherine, Assistant Chief Kokonowski did tell the Salina Journal that on Tuesday, May 4th, investigators had found a set of keys which they believe belonged to her. However, Kokonowski would not reveal details about the keys nor the area in which they were recovered. Tips continued being called in, but as time passed, the information became less useful and revolved around rumors that were permeating the town. It seemed every day there was a new story of a body being found and how it might be Catherine. But for the most part, police remained quiet, wanting to see if the rumors would get to the killer, possibly causing him to reveal himself. Early on, investigators were extremely tight-lipped about what information they would reveal, but it seems some things slipped through the cracks. Catherine had filled the gas tank of the van that morning when she was at the quick shop, and through that, investigators were able to determine how far the van had been driven, giving them a rough estimate of just how far the killer may have traveled after the shooting. Whether or not there was some knowledge of what mileage the van had prior to that morning to help corroborate distance has never been revealed. Today, police won't comment about that distance, though a number emerged at the time, allegedly being 60 miles. If true, that implies the killer could not have traveled further than 30 miles away before coming back and dumping the van. Unfortunately, setting Salina as the center of a 30-mile-wide circle encompasses a great deal of dirt roads, vast swaths of farmland, as well as several area ponds and bodies of water. Unfortunately, tips began fading, and investigators struggled to develop new leads. As May began moving towards June, police re-interviewed the people in Catherine's life and followed up on what few tips they did receive, but the case was growing cold, and they were no closer to finding Catherine than they had been within the first week of the search. In early June, Catherine's family offered a reward of $1,000 for information leading to an arrest and conviction of whoever was responsible for her disappearance. In discussion with the Salina Journal, Catherine's mother Mary explained that while she had a rocky relationship with her daughter over the years, they had talked more often and even visited in recent years, building a better foundation towards what was hoped to be a brighter future. Mary described her reaction to the disappearance, saying that for several weeks she found it difficult to get out of bed. Police had told her there was a high likelihood that Catherine had been killed, but Mary felt that wasn't something she needed to accept until it was proven to be true, and until that day, her daughter had just as much of a chance of being alive. When asked about her granddaughter and son-in-law, Mary explained that she had spoken to Gerald once a week since the disappearance and that he had been working on her farm, but was now looking to get back out on the road as a driver. In terms of Laura, she was living with a foster family, and a hearing was set up to determine whether or not she would stay there or perhaps go to her father's home. According to Laura, who spoke about the hearing years later, it went about as well as expected, and it was the last time she ever saw her father. Talking to Erin Matthews, she explained, quote, "He sat across from me with his head down the whole time. He didn't look at me once. The social worker asked if I wanted to live with my father, and I said no. She asked him if he wanted me to live with him, and he said, no, I can't take care of her. That was the only thing he said in that entire meeting," end quote. For the most part, Laura's connections to her family were severed at that time, and up through her interview in 2013, she had made no contact with them since 1993. Being that it was the early 90s, DNA technology worked at a far slower pace. A year later, in April of 1994, police stated it still could not be determined whether or not the blood found belonged to Catherine. According to Lieutenant Bonowitz, they knew the blood was human, but the testing which had been conducted was inconclusive in terms of identifying exactly whose it was. In hopes of jumpstarting the case, investigators sought more exposure, approaching unsolved mysteries about covering the case, though it appears that never happened. Bonowitz told the Salina Journal that while investigators from both the KBI and Salina police were assigned to the case, there hadn't been any new leads. It was hoped someone local might speak out. Bonowitz explained, quote, "We need someone else who may know something to give us a name or other information we can follow up on. They may have seen her 2 months before, and she might have said something that could lead us to something. They could help us determine where to look and what to look for. They could tell us about friends, boyfriends, anyone who knew her personally," end quote. Bonowitz retired 8 months later, in February of 1995, noting that Catherine's case was the one which continued to haunt him and that he would carry it with him even into retirement. 2 years later, in April of 1997, several articles were published addressing the case and its status, though not much had changed. One detail was revealed, though, and that was that in the years since Catherine vanished, they had finally gotten a match on the blood they'd found, and it was indeed hers. Lanny Groseland, a special agent with the KBI, told the Salina Journal, quote, "Officially, we're carrying the case as a missing person. But in situations like this, we're really working it and considering it a murder," end quote. Mary, however, still refused to accept that likelihood. When asked about the possibility that Catherine may have been murdered, whether she thought she could ever accept that, she explained, quote, "I guess when that feeling hits me in the gut that says it's over. Right now, I feel she's very much alive," end quote. In June of 2001, police officials erected a billboard on West Crawford Street bearing the image of Catherine as well as that of Gina Cyphers, who was brutally murdered in Salina in December of 95. Lieutenant Mike Sweeney of the Salina Police told reporters they hoped the billboard would generate new tips and keep the case alive in the eyes of the public. For a period of time, there was some consideration given to whether or not Catherine's disappearance and likely murder could be linked to the murder of Gina Cyphers. Police, however, expressed that the murders had been committed using different weapons and the suspects had different MOs. While it was a possibility, they hadn't found any evidence to link the two crimes. 2 years later, in April of 2003, there were a new round of articles marking 10 years since Catherine had vanished. Lieutenant Mike Sweeney discussed the lack of progress on the case, noting that while they could have an idea of who committed the crime, they didn't have the physical evidence necessary to move the investigation along. He explained, quote, "The courts require proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Sometimes there are cases when you think you know who did it, but proving that to the court is something else," end quote. The case had grown cold and remained cold for nearly a decade, but Catherine's mother, Mary, believed someone local held the answers, telling the Journal, quote, "It happened in Salina. Somebody in Salina knows who, what, why, and where, and they just aren't talking. At some point, we'd like to know something," end quote. Unfortunately, the truth has remained elusive, and whoever was responsible for Catherine's disappearance and likely murder has yet to be identified. Over the years, there have been suspects, according to investigators, though they've been able to rule out people based on evidence that they possess. In 2018, 25 years after Catherine vanished, Sergeant Jim Feldman of the Salina Police spoke with KSAL, News Radio 1150 AM, and explained that the case was still open and had since been reclassified from that of a missing person to a homicide, officially. Over the years, Many have theorized that whoever killed Catherine likely knew her and was familiar with her morning routine, though there has also been speculation that someone she didn't know may have followed her from the gas station that morning, seeing an opportunity to strike a lone woman in the dark. When last seen, Catherine Louise Adam was described as being a Caucasian female with brown hair and eyes, standing 5 feet 4 inches tall and weighing approximately 120 pounds. Catherine wore glasses, has pierced ears and a freckled complexion with noticeable dimples in her cheeks. She has scars on her left knee, left shoulder, back, and right finger. She has moles on her chest, neck, left ear, and left cheek. She was last seen leaving the Quick Shop convenience store on the morning of April 29, 1993 in Salina, Kansas. Her blood was found at Triplett's mini storage off Centennial. Her van, with her blood inside, was later discovered in the parking lot of Russell's Restaurant on Westport Boulevard. The years have been difficult for Catherine's daughter, Laura, who has only ever discussed the case publicly once when she was in her late 20s. After her mother's disappearance, she cycled through a few different foster homes until she found one that was a good fit. She keeps her mother alive in her heart and through music, which the two shared. According to her, Catherine's one great regret was when she stepped away from music, saying that her mother told her, quote, "Don't lose that voice. Once you give it up, you never get it back," end quote. What happened to Catherine inspired Laura to ensure she could take care of herself, and she told the Salina Journal that she had been trained in Taekwondo, boxing, and Jeet Kune Do. She remains haunted by what happened to her mother and hopes someday to be able to find closure through justice. When asked about carrying that pain for so long, she explained, quote, "It has been really painful. The person who did this is a true coward in every sense of the word, to ambush a woman in the dark. Whoever's keeping this secret, it's got to be eating them alive. If they would come forward, my soul could rest once and for all. Otherwise, I will be restless for the rest of my life because of this." Is there something standing in the way of your happiness? Something that keeps you from achieving your goals? I've been there more times than I'd like to admit. There's nothing wrong with admitting that you could use some help, and thankfully there's a great service available to you, BetterHelp. BetterHelp assesses your needs and provides you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can easily connect to a safe, secure, and private online environment to discuss the things that are weighing you down. BetterHelp is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done conveniently and securely online. You can message your counselor anytime and receive thoughtful responses. You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions right from the comfort of your own home. No uncomfortable waiting rooms. One thing I really love about BetterHelp is the affordability. It's less costly than traditional offline counseling, and they even offer financial aid. Find the help you need, not just what's offered by counselors close to home. BetterHelp provides licensed professional counselors who specialize in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, and so much more. Most importantly, with BetterHelp, everything you share is confidential, and counseling is offered securely and conveniently. So many people are using BetterHelp that they've been recruiting additional counselors across all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/trace. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/trace. What's your guilty pleasure? For me, it's cheesy 80s movies like Iron Eagle and Commando. But there's one thing I never feel guilt about, and that's how much I enjoy playing Best Fiends. I love how nice it is to completely decompress and bang away at the challenging puzzles while feeling the excitement of conquering yet another level. I recently passed level 1100, and it's just as much fun as it was at level 1. Well, probably a lot more now since I've got so many fun fiends to utilize. I also can't help but admit I really love competing against friends to see who can get the farthest, the fastest. Best Fiends is the most fun and challenging game I've played that's free to download. More levels, events, and challenges get added all the time, like the recent Valentine Rescue. If you love a good puzzle game, Best Fiends gives you over 5,000 of them, which means you never have to choose between binging and boredom. So download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. A newly separated 35-year-old mother heads off to work in the early morning hours and never comes home. It's not a job she loves, but one that pays the bills and affords her the ability to be home before her daughter gets home from school. After nearly 20 years of marriage, one which seems to have had its share of problems, to say the least, she finally put herself in a position to start a new life, a better life, while providing for her daughter. Then, in pre-dawn darkness, shots are fired, blood stains the concrete, and Catherine vanishes. Police have the crime scene, potentially, and within hours they have the van. Based on the condition it was in, mud splattered on the exterior, it seems a safe bet that whoever was driving it that day took it off the main roads, likely onto one of the many dirt paths that cut through the farmland and wilderness outside of town. The blood found inside makes it clear that Catherine had been transported with the van, but the list of places she could have been taken is far too broad to search. 28 years later, and no trace of Catherine has been found. Sadly, the case was growing cold nearly from the start. Investigators had little to work with in terms of a direction of travel or potential suspect. Over the past 28 years, there hasn't been much developed in either of those departments. While some investigators have said they had suspects over the years who they've managed to rule out, there also seems to be this suggestion that maybe they could have someone in mind, but not enough evidence to tie them to the crime. In the absence of that evidence, two theories have been put together. Catherine was either the victim of a completely random crime, or the person who shot and disposed of Catherine Adam was someone she knew, although not necessarily someone she trusted. Beginning with the possibility that Catherine's killer was a stranger, someone she had no direct connection to, we have to look at the circumstances. We now know that Catherine was likely shot at least once at Triplett's mini storage. Then she was placed inside the work van and driven somewhere through dirt and mud. The storage business is located along the southwest edge of Salina, right along what I would consider to be the outskirts of town. Heading south or west would quickly take someone out of Salina and into very rural landscapes, stretching out for miles with farmland, woods, lakes, and rivers. Interstate 135 begins in Salina and runs 96 miles south, ending in Wichita. Along that route, there are several exits which quickly lead from paved roads to dirt paths. Hell, the storage unit is on Centennial, and just 2 miles south of Triplett's, it begins intersecting with dirt roads and secluded farms. You can see why finding a place to begin searching was so difficult. It seems clear that finding an isolated location to conceal Catherine wouldn't be the challenging part, but instead, the planning and execution of the crime. We know Catherine made it to the convenience store that morning and presumably drove over to her storage unit. It was there that the crime took place. Now, if we're looking at this from the angle that perhaps it was random, committed by a stranger, it doesn't really make sense that the suspect would be at the storage unit already, waiting to ambush someone on the off chance that they'd come in that morning. So, there's been two theories considered. Catherine could have been followed there by someone maybe at the gas station or elsewhere in the city that morning, or someone happened to be in the area and saw her pull into the storage facility and noticed she was alone. It seems a little more likely someone would have followed her, but I suppose either is possible. The problem comes in, though, when you look at the facility. Today, it has a 6-foot-tall iron fence surrounding it with sharp edges at the top, making scaling difficult. In 93, I know there was a fence, but likely not the one which is currently there. Either way, to get in, you'd have to go over the fence or have a way to gain access through the gate. We know Catherine was safety conscious about the job, due to the conversation she'd had with her daughter. So it seems unlikely she'd have gone about her business that morning if she saw someone else driving in, especially if it was someone who had been following her. I don't imagine the roads of Salina were super jammed with traffic at 4:30 in the morning to the point where they would just blend in. It would make more sense if she entered the gate without knowing anyone was around. Someone surely could have been in the area, whether on foot or parked, and saw her drive in. Maybe at that point, the decision was made to scale the fence. If we're talking about more than one person, that would make things even easier, as one person would be behind the wheel, while the other climbs onto the roof of the car, from where he can just hop the fence. While I know police have said nothing was stolen, I don't know that robbery can be completely ruled out. Let's face it, if someone sees a woman going into a storage facility by herself in the morning darkness, there could be an assumption that she may be opening the door to something of value. Maybe the suspect enters and pulls out a gun, tells Catherine that it's a robbery, and she either fights with him, which leads him to shoot her, or once the gunman sees there isn't anything worth stealing, he becomes angry and fires. Either way, now he's got blood all over the concrete and he's got to get out of there. Were it truly just random, it seems more likely to me that the shooter would have fled at that time, but that doesn't happen. Instead, there's an attempt made to clean evidence from the scene, and then Catherine's loaded into the van and driven off. That's never really made sense to me, at least not in the context of a stranger. If the killer has no connection to Catherine, then he really doesn't have much reason to conceal her body. I know serial killers do that all the time, but this doesn't seem to be connected to any kind of serial crimes. I mean, the killer's going to want to stop the crime from being discovered quickly, but why go through such an effort? And even if the decision was made out of panic to load Catherine into the van and drive it off somewhere, why would you then dispose of it just a few miles from where the crime was committed? You might be able to chalk it up to panic and a lack of experience, but I feel like even the dumbest criminal would know that's a bad idea. Then again, this person tried to clean up after themselves, so how inexperienced could they be? Unless, of course, the crime was done so spur of the moment that the guy had no way back to town other than that van, and likely being local, he needed to get home after disposing of Catherine. So sure, there could be something random about this crime. Stranger things have happened. However, I think when you look at the evidence that does exist and what we know for sure, it seems far more likely that this crime was planned and executed by someone who not only knew Catherine, but knew her morning routine and was already there, waiting in the dark to shoot. Police, while never directly stating it, have inferred over the years that whoever attacked Catherine likely knew where she would be and what time she would be there. If her normal routine involved picking up coffee in a newspaper, then going to the storage unit, loading up supplies, and heading out to make deliveries, the storage unit is the one place on the list where you're going to have the least likely chance anyone else is going to be around to witness the crime. It's also the one place where the killer would know he would have Catherine alone and isolated. With the gate and fence system, even if things didn't work out as planned, it would be difficult for Catherine to escape quickly. After the shooting, the killer tried to clean up the scene. While we don't exactly know what that means, it seems like the shooter at a minimum wiped down some areas he may have touched and removed shell casings from the ground, as only bullet fragments were reportedly recovered. After that, he takes Catherine somewhere to conceal her body before heading back to Salina. Why do all that unless you're trying to create some distance between yourself and the crime, or perhaps your own connection to Catherine? Could it have been just another part of the cleanup to conceal the ballistics that, if determined, could identify a weapon registered to the killer? Was it to cover up physical evidence, perhaps of a struggle with Catherine that might be able to give the killer away? Or was it something that was always part of the plan because that's what killers do? I think what I question more than driving Catherine out of town is coming back and leaving the van so close to where she was last seen. It's almost like this person wanted the van found, either out of guilt or in hopes that it would lend confusion to the case. Perhaps he left a vehicle nearby. There's a few hotels in the area, some gas stations and convenience stores, and of course, I-70, which runs as far west as Utah and east as Maryland. It also intersects with I-35, which we previously discussed. If you really wanted to distance yourself from the crime, though, wouldn't it make more sense to drive the van elsewhere where it's less likely to be found, or perhaps set it on fire to destroy any potential evidence? Maybe it has more to do with timing, and the killer had a finite window available to be able to get somewhere to get an alibi for when he was asked later. There's been a lot of different studies done on this topic, and the results have varied to some degree. However, there seems to be a general consensus that removing a body from the scene and concealing it elsewhere occurs for a few different reasons. In some cases, the killer's hoping to create distance between himself and his victim, and hiding the body will result in the investigators taking a longer time to determine that a homicide has taken place, thus allowing time to pass for anyone who may have been seen in the area. Another reason is considered to be related to guilt. The killer feels shame for what he's done, and concealing the body is done to both hinder the investigation, but also it's an attempt to conceal the crime from himself, psychologically speaking. In a lot of cases, it's done due to evidence. Removing the body and concealing it somewhere makes it far less likely that any physical evidence left by the killer will be discovered. Bullets, or perhaps any evidence that a struggle took place, scratches, tears of clothing, tissue under fingernails, and it's hoped that'll be destroyed by the process of decomposition or the inability to find the body. Of course, you could also be looking at a situation where someone's primary goal was to eliminate the victim in all ways possible. By killing Catherine and then hiding her remains, she was gone from all facets of life. She can't intervene in anything again, and the killer will never have to deal with her, assuming that he has dealt with her in the past. However, there's also this idea of domination that could be considered. By knowing where she is, the killer may feel some semblance of possession, of control. Like, even if she had gotten away in life, she wouldn't escape in death. At the same time, it may simply boil down to something as basic as believing no body, no crime. So if we're looking for someone who knew Catherine, it's a matter of determining who that could have been. We know she had only been living in Salina for about 6 weeks when she disappeared. She was staying at the Iron Crest Apartments, though she had plans to move. However, she appears to have connections to the area that go beyond the 6 weeks she lived there. We know the night before she disappeared that she went to a play in Salina with friends. We also know, according to statements made by her mother, that in the years prior to her disappearance, she had worked jobs in several towns, which included Salina. Even when she was living with her husband and Solomon, the farm was just 19 miles from the apartment she later moved into. So this isn't really a case of a woman new to town being targeted, but more so, someone familiar with the area who likely knew people already living there. We don't know a lot about Catherine's marriage, and what we do know is contradictory. Her mother described her husband as a great guy who helped out a lot and was close to the family. Her daughter described her father as being a cold, distant man. And while there's no direct statement, it's somewhat implied that some kind of abuse was going on in the house. Now, it seems unlikely that Catherine would immediately jump into a new relationship, although that's possible. But I don't think we can rule out the possibility that there could have been someone she was seeing or at least interested in, or perhaps who was interested in her. At one point, police specified that if anyone had information about friends or boyfriends, they needed to know. It's surely possible Catherine could have met someone, and that person, for whatever reason, decided to kill her, be it out of jealousy, anger, or something else. In a case like this, one of the first people that generally gets looked at as a potential suspect is the husband or ex-husband. We know from interviews conducted early on that police spoke with Gerald, but within days of the crime, it was stated in several places that he was not considered a suspect. To me, that indicates that he had a fairly solid alibi for when the crime took place, but that hasn't stopped speculation. Certainly, people have talked about the farm he lived at with Catherine, and there are rumors she could be somewhere on the property. It's worth noting that land was well within the 30-mile limit if 60 miles was indeed driven the day Catherine disappeared. However, while rumors will always persist, there's never been anything remotely approaching evidence to connect Gerald, and police have never mentioned his name. While I know people really like to latch on to the husband theory in cases like this, there's two fairly basic reasons why it seems unlikely that he was involved. Firstly, if police had suspected him despite an alibi, they surely would have tried to search his property at some point, or at least asked him to see his response. And as far as we know, that never happened. Secondly, and perhaps most pertinently in my mind, is his daughter. She pulled no punches when talking about how her father treated her both before and after Catherine vanished. Being as direct, outspoken, and blunt as she is, It seems really unlikely that if she thought her father could be involved, she wouldn't have just said so. Let's face it, in the absence of any other suspects, police would have gone hard at him if they had anything, no matter how minor, to connect him to Catherine's disappearance. So when you put everything together that we know about this case, you kind of end up in the same place you were at the beginning. This crime, as horrible as it is, was likely perpetrated by someone who knew Catherine and knew her schedule and routine. I wouldn't be surprised if the day chosen, April 29th, was selected in part because Catherine went out the night before and had to be up so early, which may have meant she was a little slower, a little less observant, and a little off her game at the start of the day. I'd love to know what you think. Is it more likely Catherine knew her killer, or does it seem like a random crime could explain away the utter absence of suspects and evidence? It's been 28 years since Catherine Adam vanished in the early morning hours of April 29th, 1993. After the initial days of the investigation, no new evidence or major revelations have occurred. It seems, for reasons passing understanding, that somehow this crime was committed in such a way that the killer either knew exactly what he was doing or he was exceptionally lucky. Today, Catherine's case is listed as one of several unsolved homicides in Salina, and while the case remains open, outside of reviews, there doesn't seem to be much police can do. In all likelihood, whoever committed this horrible crime was someone from the area, who likely remained nearby for some time afterward, and possibly is still there today. Investigators believe there are people who have more information about Catherine's murder than they have shared, and sadly, unless someone comes forward, new information is uncovered, or Catherine herself is found, this case will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the vanishing of Catherine Adam, there's not a lot out there. The Salina Journal did extensive coverage, and several local Kansas news stations have touched on the case, but details are few and far between. There is a Facebook page, entitled Find Catherine Adam, that posts often about this case, in hopes of keeping it alive. If you have any information about the vanishing of Catherine Adam, please contact the Salina Police Department at 785-826-7210. Lieutenant James Feldman is in command, and it is case number 931-02-53. You can also contact the Kansas Bureau of Investigation at 1-800-KS-CRIME. You can also contact Crime Stoppers at 785-825-8477, or you can text the word SATIPS to CRIMES. That's 274-637. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod. Message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod. Email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com or comment in the Facebook group. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers. AMS Radio, Anne Bertram, Alicia Lorraine, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Flautsy, James, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kevin Bonham, Marla Wright, Melissa Breckeisen, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Mascaritolo, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you'd like to support Trace Evidence, get some cool merch, and get to listen to commercial-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.